Hey, how much time do you devote to play? What if you devoted 10,000 hours to play? Do you really think that could make a difference in your life and your career? Well, I got a gentleman who's going to show you exactly how that works. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft. My name is G. Mark Hardy. This is the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. On today's show, we're going to talk to Yukai Chow. He's our special guest. He has a book called 10,000 Hours of Play, Unlock Your Real Life Legendary Success. We're going to dive into that book today. So if you'd like to learn how to use these concepts, stick around. This is going to be good. So first of all, what I want to talk about is the concept that I'd like you to stick in your mind. You are not years away from everything you want. You don't have to wait till your gray beard like this to finally achieve something. You are actually skills away from what you want. Interesting sort of idea. So what we're going to find then is that there's a lot of things you can do if you take the time to learn them. Whether it's a great spouse, we want to be able to do that. You have to have good communication skills so you can succeed. If you want to be a great programmer, you need skills to teach how to program, to go ahead and structure your thinking. Now, just because you want to play basketball like Michael Jordan doesn't mean you suddenly become a pro player, because there's a lot that can go into your life to which you can be successful at and get the desired outcome. So that's why I'm hoping that Yukai Chow is going to be able to give you some clarity on that and how to use these concepts to make your life better. Yukai, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me here.
So you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, because you have kind of a pretty fantastic course that you got to where you are right now, and you still got a lot of ways to go.
Yeah, so I'm seen as a pioneer in the world of gamification and behavioral design. I actually started in 2003, so 22 years ago now. And back then was a very lonely passion. People didn't understand or believe in it. They thought I was trying to create more excuses to play games, but I, you know, believed in the value of applying game design to make important things more fun and enjoyable. So I stuck to it, and I was very lucky and blessed where over the years it became something more and more companies cared about, organizations, governments. So they looked around, and I was the only person doing it for that long, or one of the very few at least. And so I just finished my second book, 10,000 Hours of Play. I wrote my first book, Actionable Gamification, about 2015, and sold over 100,000 copies. It was referenced by 3,600 PhD thesis academic journals, and was rated the number one gamification guru in the world 3 out of 4 years. 1 year I was number two, and then later they made me a judge. So unfortunately, I'm disqualified to being a guru. And my design work towards my clients like Tesla, Google, Microsoft, IDEO, and you know, Walgreens, a lot of companies across different industries, has reached over 1.5 billion users. So it's a good impact to have, trying to get more. We'll talk about that later, about my life game. What is the purpose of that? And yeah, so regularly teach some of my work, my framework at Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Oxford, and just very passionate about what I'm doing. And then there's like random other things, like being knighted by Korean royalty, you know, Society of Arts in London, and helping Ukraine rebuild with gamification. There's a lot of random things, and VR, AI, metaverse, blockchain. But, you know, that's the bundle of my life journey so far.
Wow. And you still got a ways to go. So congratulations on all those amazing accomplishments. I think for a lot of people, just achieving one of them might be the highlight of somebody's career. But yet you've had a chance to continue to contribute over time and time. Now, you'd mentioned your first book, and you sold over 100,000 copies on actionable gamification. Now, in that, you introduced something called the Octolysis Framework. We don't want to go too far into it, because we really want to talk about your second book. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that helps structure people thinking?
Yeah, so it introduces the framework that I'm so far most known for, again, the Octolysis Framework. And it sounds like a foreign word, but it's a combination between the word octagon and analysis. So it breaks down all human motivation into these 8 core drives. And so everything we do is based on one or more of these 8 core drives, which means that if there's none of these 8 core drives there, there's zero motivation, no behavior happens. So things like core drive one, epic meaning and calling, you're doing something for something bigger than yourself. Or core drive seven, unpredictability and curiosity. It's like the gambling core drive, like not knowing what's going to happen constantly gets you obsessed. Or core drive six, scarcity and impatience, because it's so hard to get, you suddenly have desire to get it. So these eight core drives motivate all our behavior. And what's unique about the Aptalis framework is based on where that core drive is on the octagon, it has different natures and consequences to it. So we have top versus bottom, where we call them white hat core drives versus black hat core drives, where the top ones make people feel more in control. They feel powerful. They feel good, but there's no sense of urgency because they feel fully in control and they kind of just procrastinate. So it's used for more long-term designs. Whereas the black hat core drives, since they're tied to our survival instincts, they make us feel more urgent, more obsessed, sometimes addicted. But in the long run, if that's the only motivation, then people could feel demoralized because they feel like they're not in control of their own behavior. And then we have something being the left side of the octagon, which we call them left brain core drives, as opposed to, you know, right side, right brain core drives, which doesn't necessarily mean it's geographically left versus right, but it symbolically represents our logical brain versus our emotional brain. And what's actionable there is that the left brain core drives deal with extrinsic motivation, things you do for a reward, a purpose, or a goal, but you don't necessarily enjoy the activity itself. So once you obtain the reward, hit your goals, you get used to the reward, it becomes stale, you stop doing it. Whereas the right brain core drives deal with intrinsic motivation. You do it because you enjoy doing it. You would even pay money to experience it. And even if you lose all your progress the next day, you would still do it today because that's how you measure quality of life. You know, how much time you spend on things you enjoy doing. So the Aptalis framework is well known and well applied because it not only predicts and also helps create and gender motivation and behavior. It also sees the consequent nature of it. Is it long-term? Is it short-term? Is it intrinsic and extrinsic? And that is why it stands strong in our industry today.
Interesting. Yeah, for the context for everybody, go out and get the book, by the way, if you're not familiar with it. But I'm just going to mention it without diving into it. The eight elements of the Aptalis framework: epic meaning, accomplishment, empowerment, ownership, social influence, scarcity, unpredictability, and avoidance. It does sound a little bit like Dr. Robert Cialdini when he looks at some of the forms of persuasion. But we're not going to go ahead and kind of war game the two against each other. But what I'd like to do, though, is get a little bit more into your newest book on 10,000 hours of play. Now, Malcolm Gladwell has talked about saying, hey, it takes 10,000 hours of practice to really master something. Okay, as a pilot, I got to tell you, I'm a long way away from 10,000 hours of flying. But there are people who have that, and they're absolute masters at their craft and things such as that. But can you tell me a little bit more about why you thought that 10,000 hours of play represented a thesis that you wanted to go ahead and build out a book on?
Yeah, I think it's because 10,000 hours has been a proverbial kind of meaning of dedicating a lot of hours in your life to a certain craft, to a certain activity. Now, whether it's actually 10,000 hours, that's a lot of debate, right? But and how that study came about is legit, but I don't think that really matters. What matters is that it symbolizes the dedication you put into something. And so the book title takes that and says, you know, if you turn your life into a game, it wouldn't be 10,000 hours of blood, sweat, and tears. It'll actually be 10,000 hours of enjoyment, having fun, you know, being happy and feeling free. And at the end of that 10,000 hours of fun and play, you're successful in what you do. You're happy, you're healthy, you have a good relationship, because everything is part of that game you're playing and the game you're mastering.
Interesting. Now, you've got six key steps that you include in that book to align your passions, your skills, and your goals into really what would be a winning formula. Choose your game, know your attributes, select your role, enhance your skills, build your alliances, and then achieve your quest. Now, these are really cool, and I'd like to dive into each one of these in a little bit more detail if we can. So let's start at the beginning about choosing your game. How does that tie into really discovering your life's mission?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to turn your life into a game is to know what is the game worth playing for your life, right? Because I have seen and coached a lot of people who are very, very successful in what they're doing. And people see that and they respect the success, but they feel empty inside. They feel hollow because they realize they're not playing their game in life at all. They don't care about, they're not passionate about this. They're just doing what their parents wanted them to do or their circumstances wanted them to do. And I think it's very important to find what is the game in your life that, even if you don't accomplish your final goals, by spending your lifetime playing it, it's worthwhile. It's enjoyable. It's a life worth living. And that's why step one out of the six is really understanding what is meaningful to you. What should you try to do in your life? And what's important is this is before you consider your talents, your attributes, and whatnot. This is simply about your passion. And so your talents come second step. So for instance, I believe that if you are passionate about music, but let's say you only have the talents of being a janitor, right? I believe you would be happier if you were a janitor for a music company than, let's say, a truck company, right? And of course, there's a lot of people passionate about trucks. And in that case, it would be the reverse. They'd be happier being a janitor for a truck company than a music company. So you still have to think about, what am I passionate about? What do you want to contribute to? Where do you want to play in? And then once you define that, then you can think about, what are your talents? So how do you actually be a player in that game? What is your role and perform well in it?
So I think it's really important to have, if you will, some realistic expectations about choosing your game. So let's say like Kevin Hart, he's a comedian, but he's like 5'5". So if he were saying, hey, I want to go out and I want to be an NBA player. I want to go ahead and be the next Michael Jordan or Shaq. Well, probably it's going to be very difficult because you might not be starting with the raw materials that you need to be successful. Not that you can't do well in the NBA if you're 5'5", but there's a couple of players who have done that. But in general, it's really finding who you are. And if he realizes, hey, being a comedian, which he's naturally talented at, that's going to unlock that mission for him. And then he's going to be able to focus on that. So when somebody is looking at that, how do you help people focus and discover where to find their life's mission?
Yeah, so for Kevin Hart, I think it's like you said, it's very hard for him to be an NBA star, but he could still choose two paths that are related to that. He could say, I'm passionate about basketball. I want to contribute, be a famous contributor to the basketball world, which he could probably be a good basketball host, right? And he can be a commentator, he can be an analyst. So using his talents, when he, especially if you know your game early, that's why it's important to go into this. The earlier you know your game, the better you can position for it, right? If he starts to do that early, I'm sure lots of people watch someone like Kevin Hart do commentary, right? So he can do that. The other way is to say, yes, no, I like the basketball world, but I want to play basketball. My passion is basketball, right? Like you identified, this is a very hard game to play. This is choosing a game on insane difficulty. And sometimes it's like, okay, well, I never get to being a pro player of the NBA, but I get to still play in some kind of semi-professional league. Some people, you know, they go to another country and they play in the pro basketball there. So if that is the game you truly, truly want to play, there are strategies to work out a path to still do it, assuming that that is what you wanted to do to be happy. If Kevin Hart really hates being a comedian, I think he actually likes it. But if he really hates it, again, my point is no matter how successful you are, you're still not going to enjoy your life. It's still not 10,000 hours of play, 10,000 hours of agony. And you know, I'm not going to put names out, but, you know, some people who are really very famous, accomplished comedians, they are depressed. And sometimes they, you know, end their lives a little earlier than they should. So I think that's very important. Whereas the height is an attribute, which is step two. And then the basketball player itself is step three, which is choosing a role in the game. And so the way, back to your own question, the way to help people find their game, of course, there's multitude of ways, but we usually like to see what people naturally get attracted to, you know. So some people are lucky, you know, when they're in third grade, they're like, yeah, I always knew I wanted to be an astronaut, or I always wanted to do this. Or I saw a role model. A lot of time it's seeing a role model, like whether it's fictional or non-fictional, they see a movie and they're like, wow, that inspires me so much. I want to be like that person. And sometimes it's not literal, like, oh, I see William Wallace and Braveheart sacrifice for his country. It doesn't mean your game is to pick up an axe and charge and, you know, into the enemy. It actually means that, hey, I want to find a way to sacrifice. My game is sacrificing myself for a bigger cause. Maybe my country, but maybe a cause worth dying for, right? Or for me, when I was young, I watched Armageddon, the movie. And some people say it's a good movie, some people don't. But what really inspired me was at the beginning, they needed to find oil drillers to go to an asteroid to drill holes and blow it up. Okay, it's a ridiculous story. But there was a scene where the White House was like, yeah, we asked every expert out there and everyone pointed to the same name. That guy, he is the expert among all the experts. So we flew our helicopters to get this one expert that all the experts said is the true master. And that really inspired me when I was young. I was like, oh, I wish I could be that true master, expert of experts. So that is a way to think about what your game would be, right? What inspires you? What role models, fictional, non-fictional? Also, it's important to think, okay, what would I actually do with my life if I didn't have to worry about money? Because money is just fuel, okay? It gets you to another place. And I really believe that your destination should not be fuel, right? Because if you're getting fuel just to get more fuel, then you're kind of just going in circles. It's actually a depressing life. You have to have a clear vision about, if I had all the fuel in the world, where would I go? What would I want to do? And I think if you think enough about these things, of course, the book describes many different methods to find what your game is. But I think you'll get closer and closer to what your true game is. And by living your life according to your game, you will find fulfillment in it.
Wow. I guess my watching Titanic and saying I'd wait till I'm 104 years old before people seek me out is probably a little bit too long of a horizon. And of course, you ask a three-year-old what you want to be when you grow up. I want to be a giraffe. So somewhere along those extremes, you find our mission is, you kind of given us a look ahead between choosing your game, knowing your attributes, and selecting your role. So let's talk about knowing your attributes.
Even with what you described, okay, Titanic, why do you want to be sought out? Then it's like, okay, well, maybe you actually want people to remember you or to seek you out. What, you know, that's important for you. And the kid example, as silly as it sounds, like, all right, what attracts you about a giraffe? Do you like to be above everyone, right? Or do you like it that there's no one that can actually threaten you, right? You can find these silly things, or big and small, and you can start deriving, like, what do you actually care about in life? And then position your life closer to that.
Yeah, maybe that's why I ended up at 6'5". Not quite tall enough to be NBA. Actually, I didn't have the weight under the boards. I was kind of skinny kid in college, but I ended up going into volleyball instead. I thought I could do a little bit better with that. Anyway, if we go back to the concept about knowing what you want to be when you grow up, whether it's a giraffe, whether it's going to be able to provide a resource to somebody else, et cetera, can you talk a little bit more about knowing your attributes? Is this something that you discover on your own, you ask friends, you sit around, you take a standardized test? What's a really good indicator for mastering your unique strengths and talents and then knowing them?
Yeah, so in most games, when you start the game, you get to choose a role, whether that's like a assassin or a warrior or a healer. And then once you choose a role, it'll give you the attributes and stats, like, oh, your strength is better, stronger than your intelligence, if you have vitality. Unfortunately, that's not the real world. The real world, you don't get to really pick that. You get to discover what attributes you already have. And then based on that, you choose your role. So that's why step two is in identifying and knowing your attributes, which are your talents. And I think there are, again, many different ways to knowing your attributes and talents. And most people, when they get exposed to many things, they suddenly have that moment. Not most people. Some people, I guess the luckier people, they have this moment where it's like, hey, I thought this is really easy. Why are people struggling? And they recognize, oh, wow, I have a talent here, right? I'm gifted at this, and identify that. Because what's difficult is the strengths people have come so easy for them that they think everyone does it very easily. And they have to compare it to their colleagues or their classmates and whatnot to identify it. Now, some things are easily comparable, like, oh, musical skills, you're performing, people can observe it. School subjects, English, math, you know, there's a grade. But there's so many things out there, like how much perseverance you have, how well you're adapting to things. Those things, you don't really know. How much empathy you have. These are all attributes, by the way. Attributes are different to skills. That's step four. Attributes are more things you are born with or you develop over a long time, whereas skills are things you can take a class on. You could go through a training camp, read a book, and acquire. So being very tall, like you describe, is an attribute, right? Running fast, an attribute. And then playing basketball is a skill. So you obviously want to have your attributes empower the right skills, not contradict the skills or the skills render irrelevant. So like if you're an accountant, it usually doesn't matter how tall you are, right? So these are attributes. And what we recommend is first having lots of life experience, trying a lot of different things. And that's when you get to say, oh, this comes easy for me. That comes easy for me. This is really hard for me. And like you said, I think everything you describe is very accurate. Ask people around you. A lot, my experience and people I talk to, when you ask people around, say, hey, what do you think I'm good at? What do you think I'm bad at? Most of them, they could very quickly come up with an answer because they already know. They just don't talk about it. And that's going to give you a lot of insights. Then there's a lot of various tests out there. A lot of people like to bring up the Strength Finders 2.0, which I think got renamed to Clifton Strengths, I believe. But it's important to recognize one thing, which a lot of those tests, they test for personality, not necessarily talents or strengths, right? Some of them will say, you know, you're an outgoing person, right? And that might connect to attributes, in terms of being brave in talking to people. It could be very proactive, but it doesn't necessarily, like how you like to do things is not necessarily what you're good at per se. So it's good. It's good to think about what those are and create what we call a talent triangle, which is, you know, what are you probably the best at compared to anyone else or compared to everything else you have, and what are the two or three really really good things, and then what are the rest of that you're pretty good at but not the best at, and you form what we call this talent triangle, and then the top five we call it the ring strengths, and you really want to align your life, your environment, and your role based on your top five ring strengths.
Wow. So it sounds like a nice framework for us to go ahead and take a look at what we're doing. So we've chosen our game and we know our attributes. And my thought is when you're talking about attributes and then skills, that the skills and the practice and things can help you focus those attributes. If I'm tall and I say, hey, I like basketball, well, I need a lot of practice to go ahead and take advantage of that attribute. But ultimately, you have a third thing which you had mentioned, and that's selecting your role. And in your book, you had a quote. I want to share it with our listeners. Most of the time, people think of their roles as their occupation. Accountant, software engineer, professor, researcher, writer, artist, or full-time parent. That's because our occupation is the value we contribute to society and those around us, and is therefore easily observed and recognizable. But there are more layers to our roles that interplay with our occupation. I call the layers our role sphere, which you'd mentioned, and they are like layers of an onion that surround a more fundamental composition. So can you go into this topic a little bit more for those who haven't really read your book?
Yeah. So again, there are four layers of a person's role sphere: your aspiration role, who you want to become; your identity role, who you believe you are; occupation role, which what sustains your lifestyle or what's the value you contribute to others around you; and specialization role, what you become good at. And these all could be different, even though it is best if those are aligned. So aspiration role, right? What do you want to become? And sometimes people have debated with me, identity or who you believe you are should be the first layer. But I really think who you want to become, your aspirations, define you more than anything else. And of course, you could debate about that. But if a person walks around and they said, okay, my goal, I'm working my hardest, I want to become the president of the United States one day, and every day I'm taking action on that, I don't really care if this person is an accountant or a musician or, you know, what, you know, are they introvert, extroverted? I remember them as the guy who's working towards becoming a president. I've actually met someone, when I met a random person who's in eighth grade and she just says, I want to go to Harvard one day. That's her aspiration. And I've only met her for like an hour and I left. And I always remember her as the girl who wanted to go to Harvard. Everything else was not as important. So I really think our dreams and aspirations, who we want to become, where we want to go, defines us more. But then you have the identity role, which is who we believe you are. And those are some values, some cultural, hey, I'm going to be a person, or I am a person who would never betray a friend, or I'm always going to work the hardest, or, you know, this again, everyone's different. So it's like, hey, I'm a person who would always betray a friend to get benefits from it. I don't know, but it's really who you believe you are. And that's part of your role in the game you're playing, right? And then it's what people are familiar with, occupation role. And I say that's the value create for those around you. So maybe it makes income, maybe it doesn't. But if you have a volunteer role, you have a family role, it doesn't matter. That's what that's the way you contribute value to people around you. And then the specialization role, which is what you actually become good at. And that not always connects to the occupational role, which obviously it's good if it does. So if there is a accounting expert, right, he's an accountant, but he's like to say he's a mediocre accountant, but he really loves to play the guitar and he plays it really, really well. He plays Magic the Gathering. And for the sake of this podcast, let's say he's really into cybersecurity, right? Thinking about how to protect his home, and he helps his friends set up, and he even helps office set up. His specialization role is actually not aligned with his occupation role. And so the way to play this game would be, how can we align this? And how can we even connect some of your specializations, like what I just said? He likes music and cybersecurity, so he could possibly create a YouTube channel that makes cybersecurity more interesting by teaching principles through music, right? And so there's a variety of things you can do. Or you can host Magic the Gathering events for cybersecurity professionals. So they come and they play Magic Gathering, but then they also mingle on the best cybersecurity roles. So there's many ways to combine your specialties and turn that into an occupation role. And so again, this is the way we think about how to do our 10,000 hours of play.
Yeah, and if he is a comedian, Don McMillan, that I like, and he started out as an engineer, and he said, hey, I really like comedy. So he does all of his comedy with PowerPoint. And if you think that's impossible, go look him up. You'll find out here's somebody who's effectively gone ahead and merged that, because, as you said, you start out with your aspiration, what you want to become, who you believe you are, your identity, the occupations put you into some sort of role that you're contributing to society, and then ultimately specialization, something you're going to dive down that. So how do people know if they're on the right track? How do we make sure that we're not going in four different directions and our life is a constant exploration where we're eventually going to figure out what we want, but we never, ever get there?
I think it's important to always be striving towards something, having a direction. I think it's okay if you keep changing directions, right? It's like, oh, I thought I wanted that. I worked towards it. I accumulated skills in it. I made allies there. I did quests there. And it's like, whoa, actually, I think I care more about another game. Or, hey, I think I'm actually not as talented as I thought in this. I realize I'm talented something else. I think that's okay, because at least your entire life, you have a direction and you're playing the game. You're living life passionately. I think that's way better than just not knowing where you want to go and just drifting to all sorts of places and discover like, hey, I'm here. I don't even know why I'm here, but and hoping that you like it. So I think follow the steps. You know, and you don't have to even go in the order because people have sometimes step 1, 3, and 6 worked out, and the others, they're still undefined. But I think by doing it, you don't have to really worry like if you're not on the right track. By spending time on it, you actually are playing and you are focusing your life and making things better.
Interesting. So it almost sounds like a Japanese concept of ikigai, where you have, it's kind of like a Venn diagram, something you love, something the world needs, something you get paid for, and something you're good at. If you can do all four of these things at the same time, it's sort of your ikigai, your true happiness. And if you miss one of them, you might get paid for something that you don't love, or you might have a hobby that you love but doesn't make any money and things like that. That's okay. But at the end of the day, it'd be nice if you could go ahead and align all of those things. But in your model, on the fourth step, enhancing your skills, how do you see people going from being, let's say, somebody who's an also-ran or in the game to becoming, if you will, a main player, and now your skill sets are to the point where you might be, really rocking it instead of just sort of getting by?
Yeah. So once we know our role, then we go to step 4. By the way, steps 1, 2, 3, we called it know yourself, and step 4, 5, 6, we called grow yourself. Okay. So The first three are about more self-assessment. The next three are about taking action. So once you know your role, then you got to figure out what are the skills you have to acquire to be the strongest character of that role on your server, right? Which is Earth, you know, our existence. And the way that I like to do it, first of all, I think it's important to think about, should you specialize in one skill or be a jack of all trades? And we feel like it's best to, if you see that as a spectrum, it's good to be somewhere closer to the middle, but towards the specialization. So you want to specialize in a few synergetic skills. So if you just special in one skill, then, you know, who knows, maybe that skill is obsolete and then you're gone. And if you special, if you're a jack of all trades, no one remembers you doing well on anything. And so that's not very helpful. But if you could have a few different things you do really, really well and you merge them together, then you become an expert in that thing. It's just like for me, I merge gamification and business together, right? And so I'm not the best game designer in the world. I'm not the best business person in the world. But when I combine those two together, I form a expertise in gamification design, and I could be one of the best people in the world on it. I mentioned some random example about the music player who plays Magic Gathering and knows cybersecurity, right? That's also trying to create a few synergetic, and yet that one is more creative, how to make that synergetic, right? But it's important to say, how do we connect these things together? And then once we have that, we create what we call a skill triangle, which is same principle. Right now, what are your top skills? What are your secondary skills, tertiary skills, and whatnot? So it's a triangle there. And that's your current skill triangle. And then you have a target skill triangle, which is where you should become, like what are the skills you should have when you reach the highest level? And, you know, to figure that out, sometimes you do look, again, you go back and look at role models, right? You look at, oh, if I want to be a tech entrepreneur, Steve Jobs, what are his top skills? You know, he's very persuasive. He has UX, UI design. He has product management skills. He has marketing skills, right? And so you look at your skill triangle, look at where you should be. And you're like, wait. I should be, this should be my number one skill, but right now it's my number seven. So I need to find books, find courses, listen to podcasts to get myself to level up to get that to number one. And this should be number three. It's not even on my current triangle. I don't know anything about this. And if you look at, for instance, cybersecurity, right? This is why I'm starting to get a bunch of projects in the cybersecurity world too, lots of projects, because they start to realize that cybersecurity is not just a technical problem. It's not just creating the best lock in the world. It's a human behavior problem, because it doesn't matter if you have the best lock in the world when the owner just opens the door for the thieves and go in, right? So people get tricked and they let the thieves come in. So that's why they're like, wow, we need gamification. We need to make it enjoyable and fun for people to learn how to apply good cybersecurity. And also they need to not just learn about it, but they need to practice it. They need to do it. And there's some gameplay learning and whatnot. So even being a cybersecurity expert, knowing the technical side is important, but knowing the behavioral design, the gamification stuff is a useful skill. And you want to be persuasive. You want to be able to do, you know, online personal branding, right? People should know that you're the expert so they can bring you in. So you want to bring all these synergized skills together to form a role that can be successful in your game.
Wow. And you'd mentioned 10,000 hours of play, but just be careful about this, because although you said it didn't have to be exactly 10,000, it's kind of a metaphor for it. But then you get people that, let's say, hey, I want to go to the gym. I want to really get rocking solid and whatever. Well, there's some people that probably put their 10,000 hours in the gym and they don't look very good. Why? Those are the ones that are on their phone, they're talking, they're watching the TV, kind of doing the treadmill like this. They're not even breaking a sweat. But the ones who accomplish something are those who really dedicate themselves to the mission. They're there. They're working hard. They're going to be sore and they know it, but that's okay. You welcome it. And they go back and you stay with the program and you keep at it and you keep at it. And that's how you're going to do it. That determination, the stick-to-itiveness. And I think by having this framework that you've offered gives us that reassurance, because everybody, when you start something new, you start out and your expectations are high. Your morale is high, but reality is your skill set's not all that high. That's why you're doing something new. Well, after a while, you get to the sort of the trough of disillusionment, which says, you know, this is a lot harder than I thought. And, you know, the first couple of weeks at the gym, wow, I've gone 50, 80, 90, 110, 110, 100, 110. And it's really hard to keep going past that point, but it requires that commitment to get past that. So, for example, what's making the difference here? How does, when somebody hits that natural, either psychological barrier, hey, this is harder than I thought, or the performance barrier where you're going to get some rapid improvement, but then you're going to plateau almost naturally, and you're not going to see that rapid progress as before. What keeps you going to keep going?
Yeah, so there's a few angles to look at that. One is that most people who are going to the gym, it's really not their game. They're not playing, they're grinding, which is why they're just sitting there and they're playing another game, right? They're playing another game on their phone. It means that they just know they should do it, but they don't actually like doing or they don't want to do it. It's not really part of their true drive. And I would still say 10,000 hours of lackluster casual play at the gym is still better than people who don't go to the gym at all, right? If you're on a treadmill on your phone for 10,000 hours, you're going to be better in shape than people who are sitting on the couch for 10,000 hours, right? Mm-hmm. But obviously, the people who are playing the game hardcore, they're playing the game seriously because they're passionate about it and they see it as a game, and there's multiple ways to gamify your workout or your learning your skill. And that's another part of the job, my job that I do. You can make it enjoyable and you can have the mindset of seeing it as a game. Those are the people who are truly successful, right? So I worked from like 9 a.m. to 2, probably 2 to 3 a.m. every single day, okay? Because I work with all three time zones, America, Europe, and Asia. And people think that's crazy, but I don't think I'm working. I think I'm playing my favorite game every day. And I don't like to go on vacation. It's like, why should I go to the beach when I'm playing my favorite game? Right. And so if I'm competing with someone who every hour is agony, is discipline, is grinding, I'm going to win automatically. Right. Because sooner or later, they're going to burn out. And I'm just starting. I'm just excited. I'm having fun. So when you position what you're doing as a game and you gamify that, you no longer need discipline. You don't need discipline to play your favorite game. You need discipline to stop playing your favorite game. Right. And so that's number one. Number two, there is this concept with attributes. Right. Step two, which is attributes. Sometimes when you choose something that you don't have attributes in, no matter how hard you try, you just can't break through. Just like you mentioned again, where if you're not tall enough, your attributes limit how successful you can be in this basketball career, basketball skill, right? And so some people, they aren't empathetic enough. They just can't see the feelings of other people. They can't feel it. They don't care at all. So they're going to be relatively limited as a coach, because a coach oftentimes need to build rapport, needs to build empathy. Sometimes they can learn some skills to make up for it, but it's just harder. You have to work harder than other people. So that's a second component to it. And then the third is just, we talk about quest design, which is step six. And those are giving you win states to keep you motivated, designing, your minor quest, major quest, and your task, to see what are the ways to keep things fun and enjoyable. So because you say, oh, you see progress, and you get stuck. But if you're gamifying your quest very well, your activities, you tend to get that extra push to get to the next phase.
Got it. So you'd mentioned step six, achieving your quest. So let's do five and six, building your alliances and achieving your quests. First of all, why build an alliance? I mean, we've talked about knowing yourself. I think about when I train for running my marathons, I've run Marine marathons, and I did all my training alone. I didn't have an alliance, although I did have a book. Now, people said, there's no way you can train alone. Well, I didn't know you couldn't do it, so that's what I did. But I would think if I had a support group and someone else has said, hey, come on, it's raining, but come on, I'm going to meet you at 0600, G-Mark, let's go. You're like, yeah, okay, fine. You drag yourself out and do it. What's the advantage of building your alliances? Then how does that help you ultimately achieve your quest?
Yeah, so your allies are often people playing the same game as you, but a lot of times they have different attributes and roles and skills. So they're complementary to you. And, you gave an example about, hey, just working out, you possibly can do it by yourself. But as you also mentioned, having a support group would be useful. But a lot of other more complex games, like if you want success in life, usually you need people around you to help you with your success. Like some people are starting their own companies. And, one's a more marketing sales role, one's a more engineering role, even if they're both business roles, because it's a business related company, like one is more extroverted, they're good at sales, and other is more organized, good at the operations and accounting, whatnot. It's still important to have these roles. You also need to have allies in terms of your potential customers, allies that are, watching your podcast show, et cetera. And so in the case of a workout, I think you could be successful on your own, but all else being equal, if you had a good coach, you would be more successful. And maybe if it's a very, very world-class coach, then you'd be way more successful than you without that coach. And if you had a friend group who goes regularly, then, again, you won't need discipline to go anymore, because it's a natural thing. It's what they say, your closest five friends determine who you are, right? There's a difference that you're the average of the five or whatnot. But if all your friends are doing it, then you just have this natural momentum to go do these things. And so in my book, I talk about even someone like Leonardo da Vinci, you know, even though he had massive attributes, massive talents and massive skills, you know, things he did at the time wasn't even discovered independently by humans like 400 years later. Like he had writings about physics and gravity and traction 200 years before Isaac Newton did. And he invented the helicopter. He did all that stuff, but he didn't know how to build allies. And so, so before he was 40, he was considered a loser. You know, he couldn't surround himself with a team that could make him successful. So he was always distracted. There was like a 5-year period where he was a freelancer and he only got 3 projects and he couldn't finish any of them. And he was depressed. And only when after his 40, he learned, okay, I need to build relationships. I need to go become acquainted with the Duke of Milan and also his court and learn from them. And then he started getting projects. He surrounded himself with people that could help him focus, get things done. And then later on, he also applied these skills when, you know, the king of France invaded and his whole place was dismantled. He's like, eventually that were his way to sit next to the king of France. And he was honored in his later his life. So even someone like Leonardo da Vinci, he needs to build alliances. So I think most people, if you build alliances in your life, that's related to your game and your role and your skills, you would be way more successful.
Yeah, so let's kind of do a recap here and then get some last thoughts from you. So we've talked about 6 important steps to unlock your real-life legendary success. Number 1, you choose your game. You really want to discover your life's mission. Number 2 is to know your attributes. These are the things that you kind of come naturally to, like being tall or whatever. Master those unique strengths and skills. Then number 3, select your role. Define your identity, your ideal role in your journey. Number 4, enhance your skills so you can develop the expertise that's necessary to accomplish your goals. Number 5, build your alliances that we've been talking about. Surround yourself with the right people. And those alliances aren't necessarily mentors. They could be people who could help you achieve because they have complementary skill sets to what you're looking for. And then number 6, of course, achieve your quest. Design these actions that lead to ultimate success. So final thoughts in terms of ways that people can get there. I think you've laid it out very nicely. Obviously, we're going to refer people to your book. I'm going to go ahead and put the link in our show notes. But any last comments here before you wrap up?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that having the alignment all 6 steps is the most important, because there are books out there that just talk about how to find your passion in your life. And there are books out there that say, you know, how do you do networking, right? And how, and there's tons of books about how to acquire certain skills. But what we saw in our studies in the book is that only when you have all 6 of these steps aligned would you have legendary success. So, you know, every successful person we looked at in today's world or history, you know, like Steve Jobs, like Gandhi, like Da Vinci, we looked at Oprah, we looked at Elon Musk, all of them, when they only had 5 of the 6 steps, they were not as successful. But when they had the 6 steps all aligned, suddenly their life took off. So that's why it's important to know that, you know, your role should be connected to your attribute and your game. Your skills should be connected to your role and your attributes. Your ally should be based on your game and your role. And your quest should be based on improving your skills and building chemistry with your allies and getting close to your game, right? All these things need to come together. So I think that's the most unique thing about the book, Unique Value, besides the fact that it's a lot of fun to read and a lot of fun to apply, because, you know, we're not trying to make people go through agony and achieving success through depression, right? We want people to achieve success and joy and fun. And that's why I think the book is a cool thing to check out.
It is. Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate your time. This has been an awesome show. For those who are stuck through to the end, as I say, we'll put the link to the book, 10,000 Hours of Play, Unlock Your Real Life Legendary Success. Yukai Chow, thank you very much for being part of our show today at CISO Tradecraft. For our listeners, thank you for being part of our audience. If you're not already following us on LinkedIn, please do so. And if you're following us on our podcast channel, it's great. If you can, give us a thumbs up or a 5-star, whatever evaluation, not because we're grave grubbing, but it helps other people find us because we get improved in the search engines. And otherwise, wishing you the best of luck in your career for becoming a CISO or improving your cybersecurity skill set. Until next time, this is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Stay safe out there.